couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be going to war with Fury. We're going to be falling in love with the best of me. We're going to be celebrating the Day of the Dead with the Book of Life. And we're going to get drunk with an old man in St. Vincent. And we're going to do a lot of things that I really can't talk about on the radio with men, women, and children. That's a movie. I'm not saying I'm going to do something to men, women, and children. It's a movie. Don't start sending me hate mail just yet. We're also going to be talking about some rants about movie news. The trailer park. We're going to have the box office. I got the world famous DVD roundup. Got a lot of stuff happening, so let's just kick this off. But before we get started, a big fat guy's welcome to a new affiliate, WVFT, Freedom 93 in Tallahassee, Florida. You can join me every Friday night at midnight for Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk about how to get in touch with me. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
All right, let's roll right into the news. Oddly, a slow but fast news week. Let's talk about just some casting news. A bunch of casting news dropped recently. Javier Bardem is going to be playing a villain in the next Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Dave Bautista is going to be playing a Bond villain, I think a henchman, in the next James Bond movie. It kind of dovetails in with the death of Richard Kiel. I mean, that was one of the greatest Bond henchmen ever. I hope they go bring back the more colorful henchmen. I don't want to just see a big guy. I want to see a guy with like metal teeth, you know, and the hook hand. Because we also lost Jeffrey Holder. He played one of the henchmen in Live and Let Die. So it's not been a good couple weeks for Bond henchmen. But now we got Dave Bautista going to be picking up the reins, hopefully doing some cool things in the next Bond movies. There's been a bunch of TV news. I really don't cover TV. And of course we have Arrow doing well, and you just had Daredevil, and of course you got like the American Horror Story and Walking Dead coming back. I don't care about those. I'm just not a fan. But they're greenlighting a whole bunch of television shows based on movie series. You got Resident Evil, Underworld, The Mortal Instruments. I don't get that one. I mean, Resident Evil and the Underworld movie series aren't huge hits, but they're enough to keep the series going, and they've made like 5 or 6 installments of each. The Mortal Instruments unabashedly bombed last summer. Yet it's getting a TV series. And who knows? Sometimes TV series do well. Apparently the DC series, you had Smallville, and now you've got Gotham and Arrow and The Flash. These series apparently are pretty good, whereas Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they're really struggling to get their TV series off the ground. Oddly enough, sharing the same universe with the really awesome movies, whereas DC's kind of contain themselves outside of the films. DC has had a huge piece of news. They dropped on us the slate of movies that will go between now and 2020. And the problem with this piece of news is it's nothing new. It's a bunch of stuff we already knew. I mean, I think the biggest thing we learned in this was that Ezra Miller, who is from We Need to Talk About Kevin and Perks of Being a Wallflower, he's going to be playing the Flash in the movie version, not the TV. But they mentioned all these movies that we already knew were coming because it was leaked this summer. Suicide Squad, Wonder Woman with Gal Gadot, Green Lantern, Aquaman. Jason Momoa is going to be playing Aquaman. Again, we already knew that. And this kind of leads into sort of a rant I have. When this news broke as more than a rumor this summer, it was leaked. That was when it was news. When DC officially announced it, it's not much news if you already know what it is. You know, it'd be like a presidential election when you're watching the returns. You know pretty much, with the exception of like what happened in 2000, you know who's going to be president. Usually by the time you go to bed. Because they have an idea of where it is. And yeah, you have some things where they're, let's wait till the final returns are in. And of course, you had the thing in 2000 with Bush and Gore and the real super close election. But pretty much every other presidential election, you know, going to bed, who's going to win? And it would be like 2 weeks later or 6 months later, breaking news, new president is going to be this person. It's old news, even if it's not been confirmed until finally at a certain point. But ultimately, this dovetails into my problem with the slow news week that led up to it. There was a whole bunch of Marvel and DC information that came out. And a lot of it isn't really news. A lot of it is more or less personal conjecture and dissection and discussion about it, which is fine. I mean, if you have a, and it's mostly happening on the web. If you have a website and it caters to superhero fans and it's a geek site, analyze it all you want. But if you're going to become a, you know, a legitimate news source outside of just geek news and you want to be taken seriously just by regular people, don't put spoilers in the headline and actually report real news. Otherwise, count it as a feature, count it as editorial, because what we're seeing, I'm not even reading this stuff, because apparently when they dropped this Marvel information, it just was loaded with spoilers. I'm like Robert Downey Jr. is going to be involved in Captain America 3. I didn't read any further because apparently the news stories included massive amounts of story spoilers because it relates to stuff that happened in the comic books. I'm sorry, people. Movies are not comic books, and the comic books have a much smaller audience, and that's great that you've read them, but don't start reporting the news and then saying, well, it's not a spoiler. It's been in the books for years. No. Report the news for movie news. You want to stay in comic book news? Stay in comic book news. It's when you cross over. A lot of these geek internet journalists just have no respect for the people who don't know or read the source material. And those are the people that made their favorite characters famous. You would not have Iron Man and the Avengers as movies had the movies not taken off and had a factor of 10 times or 100 times as many people seeing the films as reading the books. This is how it works. Ultimately, what we're seeing in internet journalism right now, when there are websites that started out as just analyzing geek trends, and now they've become legitimate news sources, and they're chasing traffic, and they're chasing readers. And so they're trying to get people to read. And just as the news media now will talk about sensationalism, that's why everyone's talking about Ebola. Because they want people to listen. That's why they're fear-mongering in Ebola on both sides, because they want people to listen to their news or watch their broadcasts. The lines are getting blurred, and these internet outlets are their own worst enemy at times, finally resorting to clickbaity headlines for news that's not news when it comes to Marvel and DC and Star Wars. Ultimately, this is like what happened after any big news event, after 9/11, after the Gulf War, after an election, where 24-hour news, people are watching 24-hour news, and then you get back to the regular day, and there's really only about a half hour, an hour of news to report. The rest, you just have to scramble to keep viewers. And these online outlets are falling in the same traps that some of these 24-hour news stations do. All right, enough of the rant. Let's move into the trailer park. First film I want to talk about is Taken 3. Liam Neeson kicking butt again. It opens on January 9th.
There are things I've done in my life, and I was always ready to face the consequences to protect my family. What do you know?
What I know is soon everyone you love will be dead.
What's your first priority here, Inspector?
My job is to bring you in.
My first priority is to protect the only one I have left.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to finish this.
The only problem I have with this movie is it just, I get tired of movies that perpetuate themselves and just completely ruin a character. And I mean, I know he's trying to save people, but in the trailer, bad things happen to his wife, which negates any sort of saving he did in the last movie. And that's the only problem I have. But ultimately, it looks like it's going to be a butt-kicking movie. And I'll watch any Taken movie. I like Liam Neeson. I think he's awesome. And in January, it'll be nice to see a fun film in January as opposed to some garbage that they normally release. The next one I want to talk about is Tomorrowland, which is directed by Brad Bird. It opens on May 22nd.
What if there was a place? A secret place? Where nothing was impossible.
No way.
A miraculous place. Where you could actually change the world. You want to go?
This is a perfect teaser because it's exactly what it needs to do. It teases the movie, teases the concepts. You get a glimpse of what happens. You get an idea that it's an impossible world. And a person can travel there, but it's not really spoiling anything. I'm sure the trailer, when they finally drop trailer 1 and 2 and 3 in international, we're going to spoil everything. But as it is right now, this is a great trailer because it gets me interested in the movie. It shows me it's going to be action. It shows me it's going to have vision, but it doesn't give the story away. I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Book of Life and The Best of Me, dear God. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys in the Movies coming back. We're going to roll right into the films. The first one I want to talk about is The Book of Life. Legends of the Mexican celebration of the Day of the Dead are brought to life in this colorful animated film.
I'll do anything to be with Maria.
Are you certain?
With all my heart.
Done?
Where am I?
Welcome to the land of the Remember.
Please help me reunite with the love of my life.
Stay here with us.
We have epic fiestas every day.
Why don't you pick on someone your own size?
Because no one's that big, man.
Hey, buddy.
Anyone who knows me knows that I'm a huge fan of animation. And I think some of the most innovative stuff is happening in animation. And part of it's because of the CGI aspect. Because you can do so much with CGI, but it also opens up a realm that you really couldn't achieve with traditional animation. And while I love traditional animation, you know, I love Sleeping Beauty and I love, you know, Lilo and Stitch. And I love the classic Disney films, especially the very rustic kind, like Jungle Book. And 101 Dalmatians was one of my favorites, which are very small contained stories, which are beautiful and lovely in their own right. These new animated films, you get a real sense of fantasy. You get a real sense of a bigger world. And The Book of Life definitely takes advantage of that. It's a slow starter. It's, I would say the first act is a bit rough. The framing of the story is these kids are on a field trip. These sort of like these hoodlums are, the bad kids are put in a field trip and they're taken into the museum. And then they're told the story. And most of the movie is the story that these kids are being told and they keep flashing back to the kids. I wasn't a huge fan of the framing device. I just would have preferred them to go straight into the story. The movie itself, it's sort of like the characters are puppets. They're designed like puppets. And so the character design is innovative. And of course, it's got all that very colorful, ornamental Mexican design to them. And it tells the story of these two kids who are fighting for the love of this one girl. And then as they get older, the two people that rule the underworld are betting on who's going to win. It's a classic sort of spiritual betting on the real world kind of film. There are some stumbles in it. One of the biggest problems it has is, and this is not necessarily cultural. I mean, it's going to draw from some cultural elements of Mexico, but this is the way it is with any sort of cultural traditional story. Traditional stories tend to be very epic, but they also can tend to be very sexist or involve things that we in this modern age consider unsavory or not offensive, but not quite the right thing. And in this, of course, very typically, the girl in it is she's the object. She is the reward that they're fighting for. Well, they have to bring her in and make her an independent woman, which probably in any country, Mexico, United States, Europe, doesn't matter. You take characters from, you know, 100, 200 years ago or more, it's going to be a little bit sexist and the women are not going to be these independent modern women. So they throw that in there. And there's also a whole bullfighting side to this. And the character is like, no, I don't believe in killing the bull. Now, I don't know the story that really follows this. And I'm not supporting killing the bull in bullfighting, but I'm just saying that culturally, that's a relatively recent thing to say you shouldn't kill the bull. And they kind of throw that in there. And it seems extremely awkward when they throw it in because it's trying to address a cultural issue and sort of shame the culture while at the same time honoring it. And yeah, traditions can change, but it just, the movie at times with those things seems to be at odds with itself. The other problem is it's produced by Guillermo del Toro and he's Mexican. And I don't know history and personal cultural history of the other people involved, but there are other, it seems to be, there's a lot of Hispanic influence in this. And it were not, it would probably be one of the most racist movie ever made. It's literally a scene where they show a map of Mexico and put a giant mustache on Mexico. And I'm like, that's funny, but that's really racist. I don't care if you're the Mexicans doing that. That's still racist. And the other thing that happens, all the bad guys in it, the actual bad guys, the human bad guys, they all look like the Frito Bandito. Which, if you don't know who the Frito Bandito is, you don't know because it was a character that was phased out. It was a mascot for Fritos, but it was a highly offensive, you know, he had the big mustache and the sombrero and he had the belts of bullets and the guns because he'd steal Fritos. Yeah, you know, I kept expecting Speedy Gonzalez and Slowpoke Rodriguez to come walking through the frame. That's I mean, it's a fun movie. It really is. And those are just, that's like overly analyzing the film. For a kid's movie, it's fun. It's got action. It's better in the last half than the first half, so it gets better as it goes along. And that's a good thing. Plus, it's gorgeously animated. I'm still going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is The Best of Me. In the latest Nicholas Sparks romance, a privileged girl gets in a relationship with a blue-eyed hottie from the wrong side of the tracks, and someone probably dies. No, seriously, I wrote that before I even saw the movie. So that's not spoilers. That's me just talking about what Nicholas Sparks movies are.
Amanda?
Dawson.
It's been a long time.
20 years.
21. But who's counting? What's going on
this is
me. I miss this. Loves
all of you. A lot of things have changed since I last saw you. I don't know what happened.
Life. Perfect. There was so much you wanted to do.
I wanted to do it with you. I blame you for thinking that you knew what was best for me when it was you that was best for me.
When I walked out of my screening of this, the local rep says to me, "Oh, what'd you think?" And I go, "Well, this is a quintessential Nicholas Sparks movie," which means I pretty much hated it. I can't stand Nicholas Sparks. He's so cheesy and so schmaltzy, and his stuff is so cliche, and it's so easily predictable, and it's all the same. That blurb, I'm not spoiling anything, because that's what a Nicholas Sparks movie means to me. Privileged girl, hot guy who has no character development aside from the fact that he just loves the girl. And at some point, somebody dies. There's always somebody dies in the movie. It's like I literally was once sitting there taking bets with a critic trying to figure out who's going to die in this movie. It is so weepy and sappy. You know, like Safe Haven was bad. And to me, it marked the level of corniness and cheesiness where it's almost turning in on itself. It's like a snake eating its tail. The Nicholas Sparks movies are going to turn into caricatures of themselves. The Notebook was an okay movie. This one's just ludicrous. Part of it is they cast young actors and adult actors, like people in their 30s and 40s, and then they cast kids in their 20s to tell these two stories going on simultaneously, the past and the present. Flashes back to 1992, which makes me feel incredibly old. Michelle Monaghan plays the woman as an adult, and that's great and all, except that somehow her eye colors change and her nose completely changes. Not as much as the guys. James Marsden plays the grown-up guy, and the guy who plays the younger version of him doesn't even look anything like him. The head's different shape, face is different shape, nose is totally different. He's got blue eyes, but his hair's different. He's taller. Maybe if you cast John Cho or Cal Penn, they could have looked more different. But it was almost impossible to get to the level of belief that they were the same person. And they're not even trying anymore. The dialogue is so corny, and it's so schmaltzy, and it's so predictable, and all the characters are just walking cliches. And it is so dumbly predictable that there's a big reveal at the end that when they give the reveal, I remember thinking, didn't we already know this? I mean, because they literally have a scene that I thought revealed the information that we had. But no, they had another scene where they had to pretty much spell it out for you. And look, you know what? If you love Nicholas Sparks movies, that's great. Go see this. Weep, bring your tissues, and love it. I don't. I think they're terrible. Anyways, The Best of Me totally sucks.
It sucks.
Need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about Fury and Men, Women, and Children. Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's go to war. Let's go to war with Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf and Logan Lerman. Do you even know who Logan Lerman is? Percy Jackson. Percy Jackson and Achilles go to war in a tank. In Fury, Brad Pitt leads a tank crew in Germany in the final bloody days of World War II.
I started this war killing Germans in Africa. Now I'm killing Germans in Germany. I won't ask you to do anything I haven't done myself. Comp check.
Photo check.
Bottle check.
Get out! Do your job! Do what you're here for!
ideals are peaceful. History is violent.
I love a good war movie, but this film, I think it's overly done. There's a certain approach this film's taking, and it's a war is hell kind of thing. And I'm not discounting that. War is a rough thing, and I've never been to war. I don't want to go to war. And I have the utmost respect for the men and women who go to war and the people who fight on the front line, and also for the victims, the innocent victims on the countryside that deal with the blowback and collateral damage of war. But you know what this film reminds me of? This film reminds me of that wash of war movies that came in the wake of the Iraq War. Post-2003, after Afghanistan, after 9/11, and after the United States invaded Iraq, there were a bunch of movies that came out that showed soldiers just basically as nutty headcase people who couldn't possibly just even function in regular life. And I always found those insulting because, yes, people do have PTSD. And, yes, people do have to deal with some pretty awful stuff. But everybody who comes back from war isn't coming back as a shell-shocked lunatic. And that's sort of how they're presented in this film. Now, I'm not asking for the overly romanticized World War II movies from the 40s and the 50s, but I mean, I think it just went too far in the extreme of craziness. And granted, the whole thing's framed. It's the final days of World War II. Hitler's performing total war. The Allies know they're going to win, but they still have to maintain the front line, and they're fighting against a desperate army. And it's still extremely dangerous. You got landmines, and you got anti-tank weapons, and you got bullets and soldiers, and everyone's shooting at each other. You can get killed. It's a horrible thing. And they still have this tank that's got to go through, and they're in the front lines trying to clear the villages. And the characters are just, they just were these caricatures of redneck hillbillies who happened to be given killing weapons. And completely at times behaving completely amorally. Now I know bad things happen in war. Bad things always happen in war, and innocents get harmed and assaulted and problems, no matter whether they're in the line of fire or whether in the mop up effort. If this just stuck to war, I think I would have been okay. I could have gotten past the at times very abrasive and unappealing characters of this movie. And you could sit there and say, well, they've been in a tank for how many months and dealing with death around every corner and blowing things up. And that's going to do stuff to you psychologically. There's this scene in the middle. And this is the scene I take issue with, where they basically roll into this German town and they get rid of the Nazis. They have a surrender and they basically take the town. And there's casualties on both sides. And when they're out of the tank, they basically pillage the neighborhood. And there's in a particular scene, Logan Lerman, who's playing the young kid who's new to the tank, who literally was taken off a desk job and thrown in a tank with no training. And Brad Pitt is the veteran who's been through it all. And they go up to this apartment, and there's this woman who's trying to hide her cousin, who's a teenager, from the soldiers because she doesn't want her raped. Makes sense. Well, Brad Pitt's basically makes a comment. He's like, well, if you don't, because Logan Lerman, he's young, blue-eyed, just doesn't know what's happening because he's new to this. And the girl, they kind of have this connection. And then they kind of go in the other room. And even Brad Pitt makes a comment where he's like, well, if you don't take her in there, I'm going to. And then later, the other soldiers come up, and they're basically harassing, you know, trying to, basically saying they're going to come in and gang rape the girl. And the problem that I have with this scene is, I know stuff like this happened, and it's horrible. But this movie presents it as this happened everywhere, to everyone, by everyone. And I refuse to believe that historically or now, ever, everybody in an army are horrible, sexually assaulting, crazy men. And yeah, they're blowing off steam. But at what point is this not unsavory? Because, and the whole thing is like with Logan Lerman's character going in the other room with her, they're presenting it like, oh, it's kind of sweet because they're both young and it's in war and they're kind of cute. I'm like, you still come into this room with guns. That's still sexual assault. At what level, where does it become rapey? It's always rapey. That's the point. And it's one thing to have that scene in there and to make a statement that this happens and it's awful. But they make the scene and they say, well, this happens, but isn't this sweet? No, it's still rape. You don't present something and be kind of like, well, it's kind of sweet and adorable. Yeah, it's still rape, but just don't talk about that. That's what bothered me about the movie. Once you get to the war stuff, it gets a little heavy-handed and sure, and it is extremely bloody and violent, but you really feel like you're in the tank with them, and it works. It's just that scene in the middle that was just, I don't know what the point of this. Was it to make you hate all the characters? Was it to make you say, well, even the nice guy was kind of rapey? It's like the Vietnam movies. There are bad people involved in everything, but there's still good people, and people remain good. And not everybody could go through this trauma and would continue to be horrible. It's not going to do it to everybody. Let's have a little bit of honor. I think it mars the good men who fought in World War II by painting everybody like this. That was my problem with it. And it's for that reason that I'm going to say this movie kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Men, Women, and Children. This is Jason Reitman's latest film, the director of Juno and Up in the Air, weaves multiple stories together of men, women, and teenagers struggling with decisions about sex.
You've read through every solitary interaction I've had on every single website, Mom.
Honey, you know I just do this to keep you safe. Okay, let me see your phone.
It's a bit of an invasion, don't you think?
Don't allow guilt to prevent you from doing what's right.
So, how are you feeling?
What, right now?
It's been almost 2 months.
No, it hasn't.
Don't, you're a photographer?
No, it's just a hobby. We use the photos on Hannah's acting website.
Oh my God.
What the heck happened to Jason Reitman? This was a guy who was on Cloud 9. I mean, he did Thank You for Smoking, which is a brilliant piece of satire. He did Juno, which is an excellent film. He did Up in the Air, which is another excellent film. Had great actors, and he was nominated. I mean, he got nominations all over the place for these films. Young adult, I wasn't a big fan of, but it had its own following. His last movie, Labor Day, was terrible. I mean, like, embarrassingly bad. And this is so heavy-handed because it's trying to point out that everybody's disconnected and everybody's interacting with each other virtually and through the computer, and there are no real relationships anymore. And it's so pretentious. And the characters, everybody is just not nice people. There's one guy in this movie who's, I would characterize as a decent guy. And even then, he's sort of marginally a jerk because he's demanding his son play football. You know, this is the kind of movie that if it was made 20 years ago, people would say, oh, how daring it would be because it has this frank depiction of sex. And this one is just not. It's not attractive in terms of story or characters. All the characters are horrible people. There is one part of the movie, and it's the resolution of these two characters. They're the Adam Sandler, Rosemarie DeWitt play a married couple who are having infidelity issues. The resolution with their characters I found very interesting and real. And different. Everything else, nothing but cliches. And the biggest problem is he makes this movie and he's like, okay, this is the anorexic girl. This is the girl who thinks she has to be a slut. This is the stage mom. This is the football guy who decides he doesn't want to be a football guy anymore. They rattle through all of the standard characters, and it's just such a template, cookie cutter, heavy-handed film. It's not entertaining. It has maybe one or two laughs in it, but the freshness is gone. It felt like a different person directed Labor Day in this, then directed Juno and Thank You for Smoking. Ultimately, Men, Women, and Children kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about St. Vincent, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Let's do the time. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies, wrapping up the show here. We still got one more movie to talk about. Let's talk about St. Vincent. A grouchy old alcoholic finds an unlikely friend in his neighbor's middle school boy. But it's totally not creepy the way that sounds.
I'm Maggie. I guess I'm your new neighbor.
So?
Well, we're moving in.
This is Oliver. You can lead us all in morning prayer.
I think I'm Jewish.
Good to know.
Sir?
Take me, God. Don't play with me.
I was wondering if I could use your phone.
My house?
I can watch the kid after school. I can do $11 an hour.
Scott! You like him?
He's interesting. In a gotcha sort of way.
This one stars Bill Murray, and he's getting a lot of press for this and a lot of accolades, and very, very deservedly so, because he really does a feat of acting here. He does some really impressive things with this role. What's funny is Bill Murray's career has kind of gone through some interesting changes. Back in the 80s, I think even in the 70s, when he was coming up, he was just a comedian. He was the wacky guy, and he was doing movies like Meatballs and Stripes and Ghostbusters, where he was the typical Saturday Night Live Bill Murray character. And while that was fun, I was never a huge fan of that. I thought he was good in limited quantities in that way, but he always wanted more, and he's got a lot of good acting chops to him, and he comes from a family of actors. He's got a couple brothers who do movies. I remember when Murray did The Razor's Edge back in the 80s, it was him trying to break out of the screwball comedy. And there was no comedy. There was like one or two funny scenes in the movie, and they all fell in the trailer. So it's a very serious movie, and he does a fine job, but you could tell at the time it was him trying to break out. And he never got sort of like the dramatic respect that, say, Robin Williams did. Robin Williams broke out of comedy and did amazing drama as well. Bill Murray is equally talented. He has a shtick that works for comedy, but he has a real dramatic side to him. And it wasn't until he got into the 2000s, and really when he started working with somebody like Wes Anderson, that he was doing some pretty impressive dramatic work. But it was always in either limited roles or off-kilter roles. Like he was a very minor role in Royal Tenenbaums, one of my favorite movies of all time. But it was a very low-key role. But when he did like Life Aquatic, that was kind of an off-kilter role. It was comedy, but it was independent comedy, so it was different than what you saw in, say, Stripes or Ghostbusters, but it still was a comedic role. What's neat about St. Vincent is you're really seeing Bill Murray come into his own, and he's actually got a good movie. And this isn't like Broken Flowers, where it's just sort of going to come and go, and nobody cares about it. Well, yeah, it's a decent movie. It's really just award bait. This is a good, solid film. This is a neat movie that shows this neat story between this relationship with this old, crotchety old alcoholic dude and the kid next door who he ends up inadvertently being a babysitter for. Melissa McCarthy's also in it, and she does a fantastic job. And it's nice to see her playing a role that's not just her being some foul-mouthed creep that you've seen her in, like in The Heat and Identity Thief and Bridesmaids. She's given a little bit of room to stretch dramatically as well. And this movie really has a lot of heart. And it's one of those movies that if you can make a cry in a movie and you don't want to, it's one thing to go to a movie like we talk about The Best of Me. And if you love those kind of movies, then go because you bring the tissues because you know you're going to weep. But a real feat of a solid movie is if you see a movie and you find yourself tearing up and you don't expect to. And that's the kind of thing you get with St. Vincent. And it's not schmaltzy at all. I mean, it has a little bit of cliche in there. But what's neat about the movie is it's not there to fix his character. And I like that. And he's got flaws. And his character continues to have flaws and has flaws in the end, just as he has flaws in the beginning. It's not meant to fix those. It's just meant to be a good movie and sort of this realistic, truthful human story about two very oddly mismatched people that have a real good relationship. And like I said, when you hear the blurb of it, and you're like, oh, this old guy next door and this relationship with this young kid next door. That sounds super creepy. That sounds, you know, van with candy driving around kind of movie. It's not. It's not at all. And it never even threatens to go there. It's only when I blurbed it that I realized how weird it sounds. It's not. It's weirdly wholesome. It's very heartwarming. It's a great movie. I really think Bill Murray has a chance to win some awards with this one because he does a fantastic job with the role, and it's not just a retread of other Bill Murray things you've seen. So when it comes to St. Vincent, I want to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Yay! All right, you're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I predicted Gone Girl was going to get $25 million, and I was, again, pretty close, $26.5 million. Was what Gone Girl got. It only dropped less than 30%, which is really good from weekend to weekend. And Dracula Untold came in very close second with $23.5 million, just a couple million dollars less. I thought Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day was going to do a little bit better, but still it made over $18 million last week. That's a win for the studio. That's a win for the movie, especially since it really skewed towards a younger audience. The Judge did okay with $13 million. It was down at number five. Annabelle was just above it. Annabelle dropped a lot more than Gone Girl, but you expect that. I mean, Annabelle cost $6 million to make, and it's a huge profit right now because it's at 60-some million, and that basically means it's made back all its money and probably all of its marketing, and it's only the second week in theaters. And you still got Halloween in 2 weeks. Kill the Messenger did not do well at opening. In limited release, it was in a little less than 400 theaters, and it didn't even make $1 million. Came in 15th. I think Jeremy Renner's hopes of this being the award bait film, like last year's American Hustle, that's been shattered. Overall, these are good standings, and it was a lot of good performances, or at least up to par performances. Gone Girl continues to be the big movie. This week, I don't think Gone Girl's gonna win. A lot of people are saying Fury's gonna win. Here's the only problem with Fury. The R rating, I think, is gonna be a problem, not because it's an R rating, but because R-rated films have been dominating the box office of the last couple weeks. The people who want to go see an R-rated movie, they've seen the stuff that they want to see. People have seen Gone Girl, they've seen Annabelle, they've seen The Judge. So there's no like want for grown-up programming. So I actually think what's going to end up happening is The Best of Me is going to win, because there really isn't a good, well, there's not a good romance at all now because it's got The Best of Me's out there. That's the best you can do. But I think the date night crowd is going to go for this. And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, Gone Girl's a date night movie. Well, not really, unless you want to go home and, you know, sleep in fear. But The Best of Me is a very typical. I really honestly think that that's the one that's going to win. It pains me to say so. And I think it's going to be between 20 and 25 million. And Fury will be close behind it, but I just don't think it's going to play as strong. All right. That sound means that it's time for the world-famous DVD roundup. Not a ton of stuff this week. We've got the new X-Men movies, X-Men Days of Future Past, that is available. I think you can get it in a box set, like in a commemorative set, or, you know, like a special presentation if you buy it and you want to have, like, figurines or whatever. And I'm sure, I believe that there's additionally, like, if you want to buy all the X-Men movies, you can now get the giant set. They always have those available with each new X-Men movie. They're like, oh, set with everything. So I guess if you really want to just buy the, you know, the X-Men trilogy and X-Men Origins Wolverine, you can probably still find that on Amazon. There's also Mr. Peabody and Sherman, which kind of, that was a cute enough movie. And it had a decent release. The DVD and Blu-ray, the home video release, is kind of coming with a whimper rather than a bang right now. And that's kind of a shame. Fox is not pushing their publicity of these as much as I really think they should. And I thought Mr. Peabody and Sherman was cute enough, especially going back and watching some of the old episodes, which you can get on Amazon Prime. If you have an Amazon Prime account, you can find them. Those are cute enough. There's also Fargo Season 1, which I thought was going to be terrible, which is actually pretty decent, which surprised me. And you know, kudos to FX for doing some really good programming now. They're really the new edgy. They've been the edgy source for programming way more than HBO is even at this point. I mean, yeah, HBO's got Game of Thrones and it's got Girls, but I think FX has a better slate. And there's also Dracula Season 1, which you're not going to get a Season 2. Apparently that was canceled. But if you want to catch that up with John Reese, with the modern version of Dracula as a TV series. And then Penny Dreadful, which also deals with, I think, vampire type. It deals with, like, Dracula subject matter at times, which is based on the Penny Dreadful novels, sort of pulp fiction of the Victorian era. Season 1 is available. Stinker of the Week is Two Broke Girls Season 3. I will admit, I have not watched that season of Two Broke Girls, but I did watch the first season and it was terrible. I know people love it. I know there are people out there who think it's a great TV show. It's not. It's awful. And it's annoying. Kat Dennings is a beautiful woman and I think she's great. But yeah, Two Broke Girls, I'm not a big fan. Next week, we're going to be talking about John Wick, Ouija, and Birdman. And probably also talking a little bit about horror movies because I'm going to a horror movie marathon this weekend with 13 movies in 24 hours. Let's see if I can stay awake for 24 hours. Until then, I will talk to you next week. Have a fat time at the movies.